We are in Galatians chapter 2, and we are this evening going to begin to look at verses 11 through 21. But don't let that be a shock to you. We're not going to go any further than verse 11. It's just that the paragraph is from verses 11 through 21. And in brief, what this paragraph is about is when Cephas came to Antioch, he pulled a major boner and began to play the hypocrite. And even Barnabas was led away by Peter's example and whatever argument he might have set forth to set forth this faulty example. And then Paul confronted him in public in front of everybody over what kind of gospel he was actually living. And of course, that's the part, verses 15 through 21 is actually a fairly extended argument on Paul's part for why Peter shouldn't have been doing what he was doing. But nonetheless, the issue in this paragraph is a part of the thesis of chapter 2. We said in chapter 1 that what Paul was trying to do was to set forth arguments for why we ought to believe that his gospel is the truth in terms of where it came from. He said it didn't come from a man, didn't come through a man. He got it by direct revelation from Jesus. Well, anybody can make that kind of a claim. Many people have over the centuries. The question is, why should I believe Paul's claim? Well, chapter 1 goes down and shows you the arguments. And then in chapter 2, he actually sets forth the validation of the gospel that he preached, because he went up to Jerusalem to Peter, James, and John and the other leaders in the church in Jerusalem, and he set his gospel before them, and they added nothing to it, took nothing away from it, extended the right hand of fellowship to him, and affirmed the fact that he'd been preaching the truth for the last 16 or 17 years after, I mean, he'd been planting all these churches and all that, but he was doing it away from Jerusalem. So by going up to Jerusalem, he actually was used by God to absolutely set the content of the gospel so that nobody could come along and alter it later. This was the gospel of the church of Jesus Christ, validated in Jerusalem. Verses 11 through 21 are another step in the argument of validation. So we're going to begin our study of it, and then, you know, the next 6 months or so, I don't know how long it'll take us, but it's taken us a year to get through 1.5 chapters, so maybe we'll go a little faster, but I didn't put any money on it. One of the problems with Paul's efforts to provide the evidence for the legitimacy of the message, one of the problems with his efforts is that human beings are notorious for their willingness to capitulate to their irrational fears that drive them in much of their lifetime. In other words, what I'm saying is, Paul has spent 2 chapters trying to establish the fact that the gospel's true, but that doesn't seem to help a lot for an enormous number of people. And the obvious question is, well, if his arguments are valid, it's truth. If it's truth, it came from God. If his arguments are valid, we're dealing with God. So how come people don't just believe him? Well, why don't people just believe the words? And I believe that the biblical answer is because they're afraid. They're either afraid they won't get what they want, or they're afraid they're going to get something they don't want. They're afraid they're going to lose something, whatever. They're driven by their irrational fears. And Paul's argument in this paragraph is that Peter, the guy he calls Cephas, who was the leader of the church in Jerusalem, according to verse 7, Peter was the guy that God had commissioned to be the point man for the gospel to the circumcised. Peter, the guy who preached the Pentecost sermon, won 3,000 people to faith in Jesus as the Christ. The guy who could walk down the street and the sun shine on him and the shadow, when it would hit somebody that was not well, would suddenly be healed. Peter went to Antioch and played the hypocrite. And Paul says it was because, verse 12, end of the verse, he was afraid. He feared the party of the circumcision. This is what I mean about being driven by irrational fears. This is not the first time Peter pulled a stunt like this because he was afraid. Remember? Peter is notorious for his betrayal or denial of Jesus on the night that Jesus was betrayed. He had said at the meal that he would die for Jesus. And within hours, he was declaring with curses that he never knew. He didn't know. He was not one of his followers. On and on and on. So we know from that experience in this record that Peter had a fairly deep-seated fear of what people would think and perhaps do on the basis of what they thought of him. So Peter actually was moved by fear to do something in this paragraph that I say had the smell of the smoke of hell all over it. Because if it was allowed to stand, Paul said, the gospel would not remain with you. And if truth didn't remain with them, then people would perish right and left because they were believing the wrong thing. That's why I say Peter was doing something that had the smell of the smoke of hell all over it, and Paul couldn't let it go. Paul also, however, in his letters, if you remember 2 Timothy, that was the last letter Paul wrote. And he wrote it to a man in his probably mid-30s, Timothy, with whom he had worked for, there's no telling how many years, years and years. He wrote him a letter and told him to kick it in gear again. He said, ignite, reignite the gift of God that's in you. Because God has not given us a spirit of fear. So Timothy was apparently intimidated and fearful. And even after many years in ministry, was willing to let his gift languish because to use it meant to be out there on the front lines getting shot at. And he was afraid. Not only Peter and Timothy, but Paul himself in his letter to the Philippians asked the Philippians to pray for him so that he would not capitulate to fear when it came time for him to stand up in court under a charge from Rome that he was in somehow opposition to Caesar. And he knew that it was a death penalty charge. And he didn't want to capitulate, and he wanted to be faithful to the message and declare it openly and forcefully and boldly. And he asked them to pray for him, and he wouldn't ask that if he hadn't have been aware of the fact that fear often kills people's faithfulness. And he even said that his imprisonment actually encouraged others who were afraid of the consequences of faithfulness. By seeing him in prison suffering for it, they were emboldened to speak, which meant until they had that example on his part, they were driven by fear and they were keeping quiet. So I really get this thing in this paragraph that it's a big issue in the scriptures that we probably never ultimately, finally get over in this life the things that are the deepest seated fears we have. There are things we have to struggle with, and we have to claim the truth of the scriptures by faith in order to overcome them. Because if we don't, we'll capitulate to them and we'll find ourselves being unfaithful at a time when we ought to be being faithful. So this paragraph is part of Paul's effort to get the Galatians to be faithful. But in the face of what he says about Peter, you have to wonder, well, just how much good does it do to know the truth, if I'm really afraid? That's one of the problems. One of the benefits of Paul's efforts is, as he said to the Philippians, there are actually some who do take courage from the details of the truth, and then they live above themselves by the fearless Spirit of God, by a faithful dependence on His supply of courage in the face of fear. Much like the early church did when they were threatened with all kinds of things, and the church came together and they began to pray. And they said, Lord, you see their threatenings. You see what they're saying they're going to do to us. Give us the courage to be faithful. And the place was shaken by the Spirit of the Lord, and they were emboldened. So it's possible to live above our fears. It's possible. On the other hand, with the paragraph's reality, one of the benefits of this paragraph is that the common failure of human beings to be faithful in the face of their greatest fears is actually a tremendous argument for the truth of Paul's gospel, which says that God will grant us righteousness on the basis of Jesus, apart from whether we're courageous or fearful or whatever. It's apart from anything we do. It's a grant of grace where He freely forgives us when we put our trust in the Jesus who was not afraid, or if He was afraid, didn't ever give in to it and went to the cross sinlessly and died in our place. Well, what if God had made the gospel that I'll save you if you overcome your fears? If you achieve fearlessness, then I'll give you salvation. Would that have been a gospel of grace? No. So, even Peter's failure is, in a sense, a backdoor argument for the fact that God is a God of grace. He didn't toss Peter out on his ear when he pulled this boner. Even when he was denying that he knew Jesus, Jesus heard him. And he just turned from where he was sitting and he looked at him. And Peter saw him and he caught his eye. And Peter got up and walked out into the darkness and wept. Bawled his eyes out because he knew he'd failed badly. But when the scriptures say that Jesus is raised from the dead, go tell Peter. He didn't toss him out. He's a God of grace. But that doesn't mean that we can just blow off our weaknesses and go ahead and yield our fears and end up being faithless. What we want to do is to understand what Paul's driving at in this paragraph as we begin it this evening, and then, you know, we'll go from here in the weeks to come as God makes it possible. I mean, if He wants to come send His Son from heaven for us this week and we don't get to study Galatians anymore, I'm not going to be disappointed. So, verse 11. When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood, the New American Standard says, condemned. Put that word on hold in your mind. Okay. I want to start with this when Cephas came to Antioch thing because there's a when factor here that I think is crucial to our understanding of Galatians 2. And the when factor is brought up because if we just read casually Galatians 1 and 2, we will be automatically, almost unconsciously led into the idea that what Paul is doing is he's recording a chronological history here of events that prove that his gospel is not from men and that we ought to believe him. If we just read through the stuff that way, we're going to think that he's just recording a series of events that happen in chronological order. And part of the reason that we'll be led to do that is because of the fact that in verse 18 of chapter 1, he says, then 3 years later, which means this is chronological. And then in chapter 2, verse 1, he says, then after an interval of another 14 years, so, you know, we get this impression that he's moving chronologically through the time frame in his arguments. However, that's not what's happening, and I want to make a case for it if I can before we get too far into this last paragraph of chapter 2. Let me start off by saying this. There's really no disputing the necessity of a chronological progression in chapter 1 and the opening verse of chapter 2. I mean, you cannot really argue with 3 years later and after an interval of 14 years that he's not talking chronologically. I think he is. But the words are added to the events. And it's the events that really establish the chronological sequence because the events are, chapter 1, verses 11 through 17, I heard the gospel from Jesus himself, believed it, and it transformed my life. That's the first event. Then I started churches. I started preaching the gospel for 17 years, and I planted churches all over Syria and Cilicia. That's got to be after his conversion, right? So it's event, it's chronological, it's necessary that way. And then the 17 years, the 3 and the 14 of chapter 1 and chapter 2, he goes up to Jerusalem by revelation to settle the argument as to what is the essence of the gospel. Do you have to submit to circumcision as a matter of faith in the God of Abraham, to whom circumcision was given? Do you have to keep the law of Moses, whose God gave him the law, written by his own hand in stone on the mountain? I mean, if God didn't require circumcision in the law, why did he make that such a big deal in the Old Testament to start with? Do you? Paul said no. Absolutely not. Went up to Jerusalem to argue his case, because there were people from Judea and Jerusalem who had come up to Antioch and said, you have got to be circumcised if you're not circumcised, and you've got to submit to the law of Moses or God will kick you right out of here. That was their gospel. Believe in Jesus and keep the law. Paul said, no, that's not the gospel. So he went up to Jerusalem to argue his case. But this has got to be chronologically the next thing, because when he was planting those churches, he had people coming in behind him contradicting his message. They're not going to do that after chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. There's not going to be any contradiction anymore, because the church in Jerusalem, according to Acts 15, sent out a letter to all the churches and said, we didn't tell anybody to tell you that you've got to be circumcised and keep the law. We don't believe that you can do that and accomplish the righteousness that God requires. It's impossible. We couldn't do it as a Jewish nation, and we're not going to lay that on you as Gentiles either. It was a burden that we couldn't bear, and we're not going to lay that burden on you, because that's not the gospel. The gospel is Christ died for your sins. And if you believe that, that means that you believe that God has erased your sins because of what Jesus did when he died for you. That's it. If you don't believe me, look at chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified? That's the message. Christ died for your sins. Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified before your eyes, and this is the only thing I want to find out from you. And then he goes into his argument. So the gospel hinges on, what do you do with the fact that the Son of God died for your sins? Does that mean that he just showed you that he cares for you and now you got to die for your sins? Well, why'd he die for them if you got to? Did he not pay the penalty that you owed for your sins? If he did, you don't owe it. If he didn't, you do. What's the gospel? The gospel is Christ died for your sins. So that's the issue. And it's the facts of the events that actually erase dispute over chronological sequence in these chapters. I'm arguing that the chronological issues of chapters 1 and the first part of chapter 2 are event-driven, not simply because the time references that are given there. But when we get to chapter 2, verse 11, I want you to think about this. In Acts 15, we have the historical record of Galatians 2, when Paul went up to Jerusalem to argue his case. Acts 15 is Luke's record. Remember who Luke was. He was Paul's attending physician. Luke traveled with Paul everywhere he went. He was on the missionary journeys with Paul. He provided Paul with the medical care for his eyes and the condition that he had there. He ministered with Paul. Luke was Paul's sidekick. Luke wrote Acts, and in Acts 15, he recorded what Paul is referring to here in chapter 2. Well, what happened in Acts 15? Well, first thing is, there are three statements that make chapter 2 of Galatians, verse 11 following, impossible to be chronologically after verses 1 through 10. It's impossible for these three reasons. Number one, in the Acts 15 record, who was it that first stood up after Paul explained his gospel, after they'd gone through all of the debate and the argument and all? Who was the first person who stood up and validated Paul's understanding of the gospel? Who was it? Peter. And what did he say? He said, you guys are testing God to put this load on the Gentiles, because it was a load we couldn't even carry. And you know my history, how God used me to take the gospel to the first Gentiles, Cornelius and so on. So Peter stood up, unafraid of the party of the circumcision, in Acts 15, And he validated Paul's gospel. So could he, after that, have gone up to Antioch and invalidated the very gospel that Paul had come up and validated, and then he had said, yeah, that's right. Could he have gotten away with it? No. Second thing, who was the second guy who stood up in Acts 15 and said, Paul's gospel is absolutely right? James. Now, who was James? Well, he was the Lord's half-brother, and he was a very godly man, fixated on doing righteousness, wrote the book of James. And James is the guy, according to chapter 2, verse 12, whose disciples had come to Antioch and got Peter so intimidated that he started playing the hypocrite because he didn't want to think that these disciples of James were going to go back and report that he was misbehaving again. Could that have happened after James himself stood up and said, Paul's gospel's the truth? Could anybody have honestly come from James after that and said, James doesn't believe that? And would Peter be afraid of certain ones from James after Acts 15, where James had actually double-stamped Peter's validation of Paul's gospel? No, it doesn't make any sense. Peter couldn't have done this. He wouldn't have been afraid of James's disciples after Acts 15, but before Acts 15, he may well have been. And then thirdly, what did the church do after Peter and James validated Paul's gospel in Acts 15? What did the church do? They sent out a letter to all of the churches that Paul had established up there in the Gentile regions above Galilee, Syria, Cilicia, Galatia. They sent this letter out. What did the letter say? It said, we're not going to put this burden of the law on you. We're not going to require that you... There are people who say that we sent them, but we didn't send them. Now, could that have happened after... I mean, could Peter have capitulated after the letter went out? Everybody would say, Peter, didn't you get a copy of the letter? Oh, I forgot. You wrote part of it. See, Peter's behavior in Galatians 2:11 through 21 makes no sense after Acts 15. Therefore, I'm going to argue that verses 11 through 21 are a flashback. But the question then is, why didn't Paul put this part in the first part of chapter 2 and then put the validation by the church that's in the first part at the end? Why didn't he? Well, I'm going to argue it this way. Paul is building to a crescendo in terms of why you should believe his gospel's the truth. The first argument is, chapter 1, it didn't come from men, didn't come through a man. I got it by revelation from Jesus. It changed my life. The proof of the fact that I didn't get it from a man is because I was establishing churches by preaching this gospel before I ever had an opportunity to learn it from any man. I got it from Jesus in Arabia, way back, right after I was converted. That's his first argument. And then in chapter 2, he says, and the second reason you really ought to believe me is, I had to take my message up to the church in Jerusalem, to Peter, James, and John, and all those fellows that were already recognized as the leaders of the church of Jesus Christ. I took my gospel up there under divine constraint. I went up by revelation, and when I laid it out in front of them, and we had this debate, and I wouldn't give an inch on what I had to say, when it was all said and done, Peter, James, and John gave me the right hand of fellowship, said I was absolutely right, didn't add anything to what I had to say, didn't take anything away from it. They accepted my gospel as the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the second argument. So from now on, you can't be a Christian if you don't buy into Paul's gospel. Because Paul's gospel is now the gospel of the church, validated by the church. The crescendo argument is, you ought to believe my gospel, not just because the church validated it, not just because my life was changed by it, but because Cephas and I, who are, according to chapter 2, verse 7 and 8, God's two divinely appointed point men for the progress of the gospel. Peter was God's choice point man for the gospel to the circumcised, that is the Jews, and I was God's point man for the presentation of the gospel to the non-Jews, the uncircumcised. According to verses 7 and 8 of chapter 2, Peter and Paul were the two primary point men for the progress of the gospel in the world. And Paul says, now you ought to believe that my understanding of this gospel is true because there came a time when the two point men got at odds over the content of the gospel, and when it was all said and done, it was my gospel that triumphed. So it's really a crescendo argument, not a chronological one. Now, having said all that, I just didn't want you to be confused by the fact that Peter's acting out of character in chapter 2, verses 11 and following is pre-Acts 15. It's not post-Acts 15. After Acts 15, Peter wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't even felt any pressure to do it. He wouldn't have had any reason to be afraid of the party of the circumcision. The party of the circumcision was killed dead in a stump by the letter, James and Peter's affirmation, and Paul's argumentation. They had nothing after Acts 15 to validate their gospel as you've got to be circumcised, you've got to keep the law, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to do whatever. They had nothing left. The church had rejected that. So Acts 15 was the watershed in terms of when Peter might have done this, and he wouldn't have afterwards. So that's part of the when factor. Paul actually used the event that happened in Antioch when Cephas came up there to be the final argument for why you ought to believe his gospel. Because in chapter 3, he's actually going to get into it. And all right, chapter 3, verse 1, bang! And it all is assuming that you've bought his gospel because of chapters 1 and 2. So, this is the last paragraph on the argument of why we ought to believe it. Paul just uses a head-to-head confrontation with Peter. He calls him Cephas for a reason. But the whole point there is, it was Paul's gospel that triumphed over Cephas' fear and was established as the true gospel. Now, I want us to remember what we learned last time in regard to this. Verses 7 and 8 of Galatians chapter 2 are the only times in the New Testament that Paul calls Cephas Peter. In his letters to the Corinthians and in this letter to the Galatians, every time he refers to this man we know as Peter, he calls him Cephas. Keep this in mind. If you do a word thing online or the Word or whatever Bible program you got, if you click on the word Peter and find out how many times it's used in the New Testament, it's over 150 times that the man is referred to as Peter. You do the same click on Cephas and you discover that Peter is called Cephas only 9 times in the whole New Testament. So, what should we call him? Well, he was called Peter by everybody, except Paul. Paul only called him Peter in chapter 2, verse 7 and 8. Why did he call him Peter there? Well, because the issue of the word Peter throughout the New Testament and in verses 7 and 8 of chapter 2 is the issue of the fact that he was the God-appointed point man for the gospel to the circumcised. Peter. That's what he was called throughout all the writings of the New Testament. Peter. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he's Peter. Acts, he's Peter. Everywhere in the historical records of the New Testament, it's Peter. And when he writes the two letters, he's Peter, not Cephas. So why does Paul refer to him in verse 11 as Cephas? Well, I believe because the word Cephas, referring to Jesus' change of Simeon's name, Peter's name, in John chapter 1, is a theologically important concept because Jesus had said, by natural birth and development, you are Simeon. Simon, Peter, Simeon. But you're going to be called Cephas. which John says is interpreted to be Peter. You're going to be called Cephas. Why didn't John just say, Jesus said, you're going to be called Peter? He didn't. He said, you're going to be called Cephas, which is interpreted to mean Peter. And then why did Paul, in his letters to the Corinthians and in this letter, always refer to him as Cephas instead of Peter? Well, Peter is the identity as an apostle, but Cephas is the identity of the man as a changed man, a man whom God's power altered. You are a fearful, egocentric Simeon, but God's going to turn you into a Cephas. He's going to turn you into a solid rock. It's a very significant promise. Because what he's actually saying is, Simeon, you're driven by this fear thing. God knows that. But the salvation he's offering you is going to change you all the way down to that fear. And you're going to become a Cephas. It's a very hopeful promise. And I think Paul just simply acknowledged that. He called him Cephas everywhere except here in these two verses. Because Cephas is the argument for the grace of God in the gospel. The grace of God is, I will save you and I will change you. Cephas is the proof of the change. That raises the question, well then why did Paul call him Cephas in the paragraph where he blew it? Well, I think the answer to that is because Cephas, as a changed man of God, was not a perfect man of God. Now, let me be careful here, but I want you to understand something. The gospel of the transformation of a person at the core of his values and beliefs, the promise that a Simeon will become a Cephas, the promise that a child of God will become a son of God, a mimic, a reflection of his father, that promise hinges on whether the God of grace actually will do it and how he'll go about doing it. And whether he'll do it or not is a question that is answered by whether you'll trust him or not. Because he will if you'll trust him, but he won't if you don't. Peter was a man whose fear was deeply buried, and for the most part, walking by the Spirit, he was able to overcome it. But when he got up to Antioch, he didn't overcome it. He capitulated. Why? You know there were other times when he had to have been afraid. Why'd he give in here? Well, we'll get into that more in the weeks to come because it tells us in verse 12 that the party of the circumcision, whatever. But the thing I want you to keep in mind is this. I really believe that the issue in Cephas' life was the issue of how God transforms us, and that the answer to that is he only does it when we're willing to keep on trusting him. If I'm willing to capitulate to my fear, my conforming to the image of Jesus will stop right there. If I am willing to be driven by my fear, Satan has won, and I will not be conformed to the image of the Son anymore because I'm now fear-driven. That means I'm carnal. That means Satan's got the victory and I'm walking in defeat, and you're not conformed to the image of Jesus walking in defeat. It's just not going to happen. So I think Peter stands as a caution to us that we can never relax. You know, we're so used to the idea that we deserve a little break. I mean, we have vacations, some of us have vacations. What do we need a vacation for? Well, I need a change of pace. I need a break. This grind will just grind me in the ground if I don't get a break. So we take a break because, you know, we need a break. We need to be able to kick back and not worry about it. You ever try to lose weight? And so you go starve. You starve for 3 weeks, you know, and you're starving and starving. And you get on the scale and you lose half a pound and you lose another half a pound. You say, I don't know if this is worth it. I'm starving. But I'm going to do it anyway. And so you keep on. And then a little while you say, I've been starving for so long. I deserve. And you go get you a great big, you know, pecan pie and ice cream. And we take a break. And you go get on the scale and everything you lost is all of a sudden right back down. All I'm trying to illustrate here is that we have it in our head that it's okay to take a break sometimes. Well, in some things that's true, but not in the conflict over your fears. You cannot afford to take a break from your dependence on the Spirit and capitulate to your fears for a little while. When you do that, you block the conforming of yourself into the image of Christ. Your transformation from glory to glory stops when you're fear-driven. So take your breaks on things that are safe, but don't take a break on depending on the Spirit to overcome your fearfulness. Because you got to do like the psalmist said, at what time I am afraid, I will trust in the Lord my God. Everything that is motivated by fear is a barrier to my conforming to the image of Jesus. And at what time I am afraid, I better not yield. Peter did. But God had a man on scene for Peter's sake to get Peter back on track. Because when Peter got back to Jerusalem and Paul came up there with his gospel, Peter didn't say, well, that's the guy that embarrassed me in front of all the people up there. He didn't say that. He listened to what Paul had to say and he said, you're right. And he stood up in the assembly and said, Paul's gospel is the truth. And if you don't buy that, you're subverting the souls and testing God. So Peter was a recipient of the grace of a rebuke that got him back on track. So that's the when Cephas, verse 11, when Cephas, the disciple maker Cephas. Stop and think with me for a minute about, in terms of the duration. God appointed Peter to be the point man for the gospel to the circumcised, right? The Jews. He did this somewhere around 30, 31, 32 A.D. What happened to the circumcised in spite of the proclamation of the gospel to them by Peter and James and John in Jerusalem in about 35 years? What happened in Israel? Yeah, Rome came to Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and they destroyed the city. They butchered the people. They tore down the temple. They wiped Judaism off the map in terms of the historical reality of Jewishness. Now the Jews are all running for their lives, scared to death because Rome has declared war on them and destroyed them. And so, in effect, we could say this, that Peter's ministry was short-term effective. This is the gospel going forth to the Jews in Jerusalem. 70 A.D., that ministry basically, historically, the gospel went from the destruction of Jerusalem, the gospel exploded in the Gentile world. Where did the explosion come from? Where did the gospel really get its impetus for movement into the Gentile world? Where did Paul leave from on his missionary journeys, and where did he come back to report? Antioch! So though God has this thing about the truth being validated in Jerusalem, the gospel to the uncircumcised through Paul, the core center of that was Antioch. So God's going to use Antioch in Syria to launch the gospel into the Gentile world. So from Antioch, the Spirit of God says to the church there, separate unto me Barnabas and Saul. And they go off on their first missionary journey. A little bit later, from Antioch, Paul and Silas go off on the second missionary journey. Antioch is the central city geographically from whence the gospel to the uncircumcised went forth. So the issue of the gospel and what the gospel is going to contain in terms of content is central to Antioch geographically, and that raises this question. If the gospel is going to be corrupted for the Gentiles, where's the best place to corrupt it? At home base. So, Peter goes up to Antioch. Did Peter go up to Antioch to corrupt the gospel? No. But, when he went up to Antioch, Paul says, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. Well, that means that Peter, though he didn't go up there to do this, Peter did something in Antioch that had the, I've already said, the smoke of hell all over it. It was by his actions, he was altering the content of the gospel. And Paul said, we are not having that. And he confronted him publicly to his face because, I don't like he stood condemned. That word doesn't mean condemned. But besides, we'll get to that maybe, but maybe not tonight. The issue, though, is, you remember when Jesus said, who do the people say that I am? And the answer the apostles gave back to him were, well, some of them say you're John the Baptist risen from the dead, and some of them say you're Elijah, and some of them say you're Jeremiah, and some of them say you're one of the prophets. And so Jesus says, who do you say I am? Who answered? Peter. What did he say? You're the Christ. How many verses later was it that Jesus said that he was going up to Jerusalem and die, and Peter said, no, that's not going to happen. And Jesus says, get thee behind me, Satan. Who is he talking to? Why did he call him Satan? Yeah, because he was becoming an instrument of Satan, even though he was the guy that said, you're the Christ. Now, why was he objecting to Jesus being put to death in Jerusalem? And why did Jesus say, you're Satan here? He said, you mind the things of men, not the things of God. And the reason he was minding the things of men is because Jesus had said this terrible thing. I'm going to be put to death. And Peter thought, well, that'll probably get me too. No, I'm afraid of that. And out of his fear, he told Jesus how it was not going to be. And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I think that's what's went on in Antioch. Peter went up to Antioch probably with all the best intentions. He was an apostle. He got up there and he did a lot of the good things until certain from James came up there. And then he became unwittingly an instrument of Satan, because his behavior was going to alter the essence of the gospel in the place where it was going to go out to the Gentiles. And Paul said, no, we cannot have this. No, this is not going to happen. In other words, Paul resisted the devil as he was using Peter, and he confronted him. Now, the confrontation is verses 14 through 21. That's the confrontation. That's his argument. We'll look at it in detail. The point that I'm making this evening is simply this. When Cephas came up to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he was to be blamed. What Paul is actually doing is giving us a thesis statement for the paragraph. Verse 11 is the statement. Verse 12 through 21 is the explanation. Boils down to this. Peter didn't want to be a man driven by his fears, but he let his guard down. You don't do that. Fear is too powerful a motivator for you to let your guard down. You will be dominated by it. He went up to Antioch for whatever reason, but when he got there, Satan engineered the circumstances so that he would be faced with his deepest fears, and he capitulated to them. And when he did, the gospel that was going to go to the Gentiles from Antioch was in danger of being perverted, not by his words, but by his actions. And Paul said, no, we're not having that. Now, let me just say this about the words and the actions. One of the few places where this word is translated, he stood condemned, is found, is over in 1 John. Remember that passage in 1 John where it says, I want you to notice what verse 18 says in chapter 3 of 1 John. Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. What he's saying there is, don't talk it, do it. Why? Well, we know by this that we're of the truth and shall assure our heart before him in whatever our heart condemns us. That's the word. Whenever our heart says, you did wrong there, God's greater than our heart and knows all things. But if our heart doesn't say, then we have confidence before God. Now, what Paul is actually saying by using this word that they translate condemn is that Peter was out of a confidence relationship with the Father. He was operating by fear and he didn't have confidence before God. And his heart was not with him in it. It was accusing him. The reason is because Peter's behavior was more potent than Paul's words. There's a guy who regularly preaches to over 15,000 people every week. He's a great big guy. And I heard him one time preaching on gluttony. And he made light of the fact that even though he was preaching to all these fat people out there, that he was a fat people. Now, you know, the question I want to ask you is this. How many people went home from that sermon and actually felt convicted by the Spirit of God to deal with their gluttony so that they would be disciplined people in terms of their eating? Given the fact the preacher doesn't do it. And even though the words he preached were true words, the actions carried the day. If I tell you something, but you see me contradicting it myself, then you just dismiss my words and you follow my example. That's why the issue of Peter's dropping the ball in Antioch is so critical. Because those people in Antioch aren't going to go by the words. They're going to go by the demonstration of the reality in the light. So Paul couldn't allow it. He stood up to him. We'll get into the rest of that later. I just want you to be real clear on the fact that there was a critical historical challenge to the nature of the gospel in Peter's behavior in Antioch. And Paul's argument was, when that happened, I opposed him with my gospel, and my gospel won. Therefore, you ought to trust my gospel. I didn't get it from me. It came from God. And that's why it even won over the man that God had chosen to be the point man for the gospel to the Jews. Okay?